You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Well, welcome everybody, and thanks for being with us. And a big thanks to Vitor Gaspar and his team who prepared the book and the panelists. I think it's a very, very important topic. And that the IMF is taking it on like this head on is, I think, also a very, very good thing. I'm not going to go into long presentations, but I am going to present all the panelists we have in one go so that later on we don't get any interruptions. Vitor Gaspar is director of the Fiscal Affairs Department. Two seats behind him is Vito Tanzi, the legendary, and I'm sure Vitor Gaspar is also going to become legendary. But then there's Teresa Terminasian. So, you know, the fiscal affairs is very well represented in this assembly. And it is one of the, how shall I say, I can't say the best known, but one of the really path-breaking departments at the IMF. Vitor Gaspar is director of the Fiscal Affairs Department, but he worked at Banco de Portugal. He was finance minister around 2011 at the peak of the crisis in Europe. And I think he has a lot to do with the fact that Portugal got put in the kind of they're going to make it club early on during the discussion. I don't know how much personal, contribution he made to that, but I'm sure a lot. But Portugal actually very quickly was regarded well by the international financial and economic community, and I think Vitor has great credit for that. Before that, he worked with the European Commission and also with the European Central Bank. The topic is fiscal politics in general, but I'm sure the Europe will come up a lot. And let me jump over Carol, who's our own Carol, to Randall Henning, because he's coming out in 2-3 weeks with a book called Tangled Governance, Regime Complexity, the Troika and the Euro Crisis. So that title is pretty good, if you can get to the end and read the whole thing and kind of get it. But I think I think fiscal policy during the Euro crisis is an excellent topic. And Randall is professor of international relations at the School of International Service at the American University. Then we have our own Carol Graham, who's a senior fellow in our global program, has been a senior fellow director, all kinds of things at Brookings in many, many incarnations. She is adored at Brookings, simply adored, for good reason, because she's a great scholar, but also a great friend, a great team member, and never has failed to step in when somebody needed some help. And her latest is, of course, her book, Happiness for All? Unequal Hopes and Lives in the Pursuit of the American Dream. It's the American Dream. It's based on a lot of American data, but it's a very global topic. And much of her presentations and other books and publications are global. She's also a Peruvian citizen, right? And likes that to be known. But I think she is perhaps one of the, the best known academic economist who deals with issues of subjective satisfaction, happiness, interaction between economic and social demographic data, and how people actually perceive themselves. And I think this is becoming a very, very important topic because there seems to be a gap between what we see in the official data, or even the unofficial data, and how people seem to feel, or at least a good bunch of people seem to feel. So, Carol, your book will be a great success, is already a great success, but I think you're on a line which will become a major topic of discussion over the years. Finally, we have Shebnem Kalemle Özcan, who is the Neil Moskowitz Endowed Professor of Economics at the University of Maryland and an NBER Research Fellow. She studies macroeconomics, finance, and growth in the interlinkages. We were born in the same country. And she gives us the honor of coming quite often to Brookings, helping us discuss important topics in this domain. Finally, there's Sanjeev Gupta, who's Deputy Director in the IMF Fiscal Affairs Department and also served in the African and European departments. He's a prolific, I see him everywhere, as a blogger or a writer or article or various things. I don't read everything, but I see a lot. Congratulations on that. Before that, he was a fellow of the Kiel Institute of World Economics in Germany, a professor in India, and I think that may be the first time we met, the Secretary of the Federation of Indian Chambers of Commerce and Industry, or at least it was a time we met once also in Washington. So the book, we will have a presentation by Sanjeev of about 10, 12 minutes, giving us the basic outline. Of course, the book is large. It's not quite as long as Piketty or Gordon, but comes close. And has many dimensions. But the focus, of course, is on the interaction between politics and, I should say, more electoral politics than non-electoral politics, because there's also, unfortunately, non-electoral politics. And the making of fiscal policy, the role of ideology, the role of pure party politics and electoral calculations. Many of these factors are taken into account. I myself have quite a few questions, but I will reserve them to the time for question and answer. So with that, I ask Sanjeev to come to the podium and present it. And I think we better stay seated. Or wait a minute, have I got it wrong? Yes, we better stay seated because there will be a... Okay. And I will take Sanjeev's, or next to Sanjeev's.
Thank you, Kamal, for a very generous introduction, and thank you all for coming. As Kamal said, my job is to really lay out the main features of the book in about 10 to 12 minutes. Before I go there, probably there's a question which must be sitting in people's mind: why did we do this? And when Vito joined the department some 3 years ago, we agreed that this was an area which we had not thought about. And we started some work, which has now culminated into this book. So that's the... Carol had a different interpretation, and she will probably talk about it later, but I am going to leave that for the time being. So what I'm going to do is to focus on the book in terms... on my presentation in terms of the book structure. So first talk about the motivation, and then look at the interface between fiscal policy and politics through three channels: elections, ideology, and divisions. And from there, I will go on to see whether fiscal rules and institutions are able to soften the impact of politics on fiscal policy. And then I will turn to supranational fiscal politics in the sense that if there are any constraints imposed through supranational agencies or arrangements such as euro area, does it make any difference to the fiscal outcomes? And then I will go on to the main policy messages. So the motivation, very simply, is that economics and politics for us, at least this is one of the main conclusions of the book, are co-determined, especially when it comes to fiscal policy. And this is because state building and building tax capacity are fundamentally political. And tax capacity is crucial when it comes to smooth functioning or financing of government's three core functions, which again are inherently political in nature. For example, allocation, the provision of public services is affected by different political constituencies. Stabilization, the size, timing, and duration of both fiscal consolidations and expansions are determined by proximity to elections. The redistribution function of the government, whether it's left or right ideology, has an implication on composition of taxes and spending. So in that sense, these three core functions are affected by politics. So to sum it up, so the political factors that we are looking at are elections, political divisions, ideology, how they affect fiscal outcomes. So let me first start with fiscal deficits. First, look at the impact of elections and their impact on fiscal deficits. What we find is that in the election years, overall deficits tend to be 1 percentage point of GDP higher, and the pressure for this higher spending comes from the wage side, and that happens particularly in the case of emerging and developing countries. I can give some examples. We see that in case of Kenya, in the case of Moldova and Kosovo. The elections also seem to have an impact on budget composition. So what we find is that growth rate of public spending peaks about 28 months before elections. And thereafter, it declines at the rate of 0.7 percentage points every month. And so the peak is right at the top. It's not appearing, but it's okay. The peak is right at the top, and so that's 28 months before the elections. And we find this to be the case in both advanced and in developing and emerging market countries. For example, we found the electoral cycle in investment in the case of Netherlands, in the case of Italy and Portugal. And then we found in the case of in the developing countries, Honduras, Slovakia, and few other countries. Then let me now turn to the second impact of political divisions. Here we define political divisions in terms of when there's thin majorities in the parliament, when the opposition is strong, when cabinet is fragmented. And when that happens, then the difference between what the governments promise in the form of adjustment and fiscal deficit and actual outcome, those differences are much larger. And this is given by the top yellow bar, and the differences are 0.7% of GDP on average. When the political strength is stronger in the countries, then the differences between the two variables that I talked about are minimal. That is, the difference between what the governments promise by way of reduction of fiscal deficit and what they actually achieve is minimal. Another example of the impact of political divisions, that happens when the countries which have high marginal majority, they accumulate less debt in the case of advanced economies, which is shown by the yellow bar on the left-hand side. They have a high majority. They accumulate less debt during an average term compared to countries where they have a low marginal majority. So the increase in debt is larger during an average term in the case of advanced economies. In the case of emerging market and low-income countries, the reduction in debt is lower in the similar kind of circumstances. And you can see on the left-hand side, the red bar shows the countries which have a higher marginal majority, they're able to reduce debt more than their peers in the low marginal majority countries. Now, finally, I turn to the impact of ideology. Interestingly, we find that ideology doesn't seem to have an impact on deficit or debt. It seems it has an impact on the composition of taxes and spending. I'm going to, for the purpose of brevity, I'm going to focus just on taxes. So one of the chapters here shows that right governments are more likely to increase VAT during crisis, which is shown by the blue bar. They increase VAT. There's a higher chance of increasing VAT, while the left governments prefer to increase top personal income taxes, which is shown by the red bar on the right-hand side. So, of course, there are some examples that we have from the spending side, but I will skip those for the sake of time. So having talked about the three channels through which politics has an impact on fiscal outcomes, elections, divisions, and ideology, then the issue that comes up is to what extent fiscal rules and institutions can soften the impact on the economic outcomes. And here, I will focus on the right bar, which is the experience with expenditure rules introduced during the electoral fiscal cycle. And what it shows is the average of spending levels, which is given by the size of the bar, 3 years after the rules have been introduced. So we find that the spending levels come down when the expenditure rules have been introduced. And the red dot gives the volatility in spending, and that also comes down. So what we see is that there is some evidence of rules being able to soften the impact, but not the entire impact. So one should not make the leap that rules will take care of everything, but they do seem to have an impact in mitigating the impact of politics. Similarly, when you look at the experience of fiscal councils, and there is a chapter in the book which looks at it, we find that they also help improve fiscal outcomes by communicating their views more freely in the country. Finally, I go to supranational fiscal politics, and here what we find is the supranational rules, such as under euro area, are effective when they're owned by country authorities. And if they lack ownership, then the compliance is not good. And this slide here shows we have three particular rules, and we show the non-compliance of those rules in the euro area. From 1999 to 2015, the dotted yellow line gives the MTO, the medium-term objectives that countries have themselves committed to adhere to. The red one gives the debt rule, and so compliance to the debt rule. So what one sees is that between 75 and 80% of the countries non-complied with those rules. The other line, which is the green dotted line, gives the overall deficit. Of course, that compliance seems to have improved since the crisis. And what is interesting is that non-compliance has remained, despite the fact that the euro area introduced some reforms between 2005 and 2013. So this is my final slide. And so here we put as a contrast the experience with IMF programs, which seem to show some high degree of ownership. So countries with the program conditionality in the revenue area were successful in increasing public revenues. And so what this slide shows is the 45 degree countries which lie above the 45 degree line were able to increase their revenue 1 year after the conditionality was put in place. And that was the case in 75% of the country cases. And the yellow gives the low-income countries, and the red gives middle-income countries. So the policy messages, politics has a decisive influence on fiscal policy formulation and performance. The impact of elections and political divisions is particularly important. It seems that ideology has less of an impact, at least in the sample of studies that we have in the book. Budget institutions can help soften the impact of politics on fiscal policy, and external constraints work if they are owned by country authorities. Thank you very much.
Stairs up here.
Okay, Sanjeev, thank you very much for this overview, which one of the advantages and one of the strengths, it's based on data, it's based on facts, on experience. Some of the results may not be too surprising because, you know, you would expect pressure on wages before elections and so on. Others are more surprising. For example, one that is surprising is the fact that ideology doesn't seem to matter that much. So while Sanjeev was saying that, I was kind of thinking, well, why could that be? And that, I think two reasons came to mind. I mean, one is that, in fact, ideology is more about composition than levels, perhaps. And this is a question I would like to ask whether there's some evidence on that. It may have been different in the distant past, but now it may be much more about levels to achieve a certain deficit or a certain fiscal policy. The other more self-serving, not for me, but many center-left governments claim that they are able to negotiate deals with the unions and with the partners more efficiently than center-right governments, whereas center-right governments may be more committed to fiscal stability, so the two may be kind of canceling out. And I myself have had some experiences like that. And, you know, in politics, it quite often happens that, you know, the Nixon to China syndrome or de Gaulle telling everybody that he had understood them when everybody thought he was talking about French Algeria, and in fact he was mentioning in his own mind, you know, he was already planning independence. So that things like that may also happen in fiscal politics. But let me address the first question or the first request for her comments to Carol Graham. Carol, what are your reactions to the presentation? And in particular, how does it fit some of your own work, which is also highly political by definition?
So thank you, Kamal, and thank you, Sanjay, for a great presentation. And first of all, just to say this is a great effort, really comprehensive, and so nice to see the IMF taking this on in a big way, because it is so much the reality of whether policies get implemented or not. But my job is not to say a lot of nice things about the book only. Let me try and be a little bit provocative about at least some things to be cautious about, because there's a lot of good rational evidence. But the big issue, of course, is how unpredictable politics is. And I think we're seeing that in spades right now, in terms of not only what's happening in the U.S. and Brexit and just a huge backlash in the rich countries against globalization, which is, you know, sort of, it seems perverse, but it is what it is. But what's equally important is that nobody predicted it. I mean, most of us were really caught by surprise. So here are my notes of caution, and the first is, or both are actually kind of odd things to say to the IMF, which is always having to worry about crises and fiscal deficits and countries who are in bad shape economically. The first is don't trust the numbers, the economic numbers, in terms of politics. So at least don't trust the averages. Think about the standard deviations. Think about the winners and the losers. You can have a country that looks really good in terms of average. The U.S. did last year, and we were caught completely by surprise by the number of losers, perceived or real, both. Same goes with Brexit. I think if you look in the past, it makes us look at the past a little differently. That's been the case in many other situations. But we need to look beyond the average economic numbers to understand what's going on. And even we need to look beyond metrics. And I think this is going to be increasingly clear in the kind of globalized high-tech economy that we live in and everyone has to deal with. And I know Kamal and I have talked a lot about this in terms of the changing nature of the economy. What's the unemployment rate really telling us when you have an Uber economy and you have people, you know, just completely different work arrangements? So we really need to look beyond the metrics that we're used to looking at, because they seem to hide a lot. And then the other thing, again, a little bit weird to say in about IMF work, is beware of booms. When things are going really well is often when you get the most frustration. China, had it been an open political society, may not have survived its high growth period. It was a time that, at the same time that the economy was booming, life satisfaction decreased dramatically, almost in, if you look at a chart, it's like this, and reported mental illness and suicides skyrocketed. So that seems perverse, but what was going on? There were winners, there were losers, there was a lot of change in the nature of the safety net. So again, we need to look beyond the economic numbers if we're going to understand politics. So I think I've probably said enough with my time. The only other thing, I agree with you, Kamal, on the ideology. I think you have, you know, over time, this sort of Nixon and China syndrome, the Aylwins in Chile, who are able to do more on the fiscal front because they're from the unexpected ideology doing what they're trying to do.
But the opposition would be much greater if they were from the other side.
Right.
Let me do a very quick survey of the panel. Very quick. Central bank laws, there are various types, but in terms of the inflation target for those central bank who practice some form of inflation targeting, there are two choices. One is the central bank chooses the inflation target and chooses the instruments with which it will pursue these targets. Or the central bank does not choose, the government chooses, with advice from the central bank, the inflation target. And in those cases where there's an unemployment target, maybe that too, of course. But let's focus on the inflation target. And the central bank chooses freely the tools with which it tries to reach that target and how it implements these tools. So the first solution, you remember, and the second, who is there anybody for the first solution on the panel?
Central bank choosing the target.
Sorry?
Central bank choosing the target and then deciding the tools to use, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's in general the successful case in emerging markets with the central bank independence.
We had a big debate on this in Turkey.
Yes. But there's the exchange rate side. I mean, that's the big thing, I think, with this thing. I mean, if you
think independent of the exchange rate side. There's necessarily no right or wrong.
Right.
But in a sense, the question poses or rather illustrates what is the domain of politics versus what is the domain of economic management. Now, if a government wants to have an inflation target, for a while at least, maybe even influenced by Olivier Blanchard, of 3% rather than 2%, okay? That's a political choice. It's a democratic political choice. Then the central bank should implement that and should use freely, you know, whatever instruments it has in whatever regime it is in implement and so on. To say that the central bank should actually choose the inflation target is a little bit more debatable, because at the end of the day, the inflation target is an aggregate macroeconomic target. Central bank is a non-elected technocratic organization. So why should it be able to choose the target?
Kamal, may I?
Yes.
So I think that your answer is wonderful. I'm wondering about your question. The reason I think your answer is wonderful is because, if I got you right, you're basically saying, look, the issue of the goals of the central bank is a fundamental political choice, and so one has to have that done in a way which is politically legitimate. In some places, you define the political objectives of the central bank in a way which is reasonably vague, like you should pursue price stability and full employment. You have a dual mandate, and both goals are reasonably vague, and they have to be made operational. Now, that is perfectly fine. It's a form of a delegation contract. What you cannot have is a central bank which is goal independent. The mandate must be political, but the frontier of the mandate of politics has to be defined by the political system itself. But if you want a good answer, you have Alan Blinder there.
I think that was an excellent answer, but let's listen to Alan's answer. We haven't opened to discussion yet, but Alan, would you like to say something, Alan, at this point? On this point? Right. Well, I just brought this up not necessarily in connection. It's not fiscal policy, first of all, although it's connected, but it is this tension that there is between democratic legitimacy and the experts, you know, and this tension has become a matter of discussion and of debate much more strongly over the last 2-3 years. In many political campaigns, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, it was good to field good experts. Now it almost, has become suspicious. I mean,
absolutely.
And so there is something, there is a balance, I think, to be struck between, let's say it kind of in a not very professional way, but I mean in balance between people who've studied things and kind of know what they're doing, you know, and the average citizen. And it doesn't necessarily follow that because somebody has credentials that the average citizen will become very convinced. And that seems to have increased a lot.
Going to build on that, and this tension between technical experts on the one hand and citizens on the other kind of plays itself out specifically in this realm of fiscal rules, right? At the heart of this book, in the sense that, in principle, right, we would want to have kind of a fiscal rules that are sophisticated and that work in a pro-cyclical way. But if we're going to do that, then you need to kind of develop you have to have the technical infrastructure and a bureaucracy, a set of experts, okay, that are going to calculate the difference between the actual budget deficit and the structurally the cyclically adjusted budget deficit, and that requires placing a lot of trust in people that are going to do those calculations, right? Because they're going to produce a result. To which the rest of the system, the government may have to undertake policy adjustments in order to meet. This may be politically challenging for them to do so. So a mechanism that relies on this is one that places a lot of trust in its experts and in its institutions. This is the sort of system that I prefer, but it's not always the system that we can sustain. Mm-hmm. And I suspect that this is one of the problems that the euro area confronts when thinking about the questions of designing these fiscal rules. But it's true for other countries as well, but especially acute, I think, now in the case of the euro area.
Professor Kalemli, this and or any other thoughts?
I just want to add, since we started talking about this is very important to understand that the way advanced country central banker like United States goes around think about these things versus an emerging market central banker. First of all, an advanced country central banker, their life is much easier than an emerging market central banker. In advanced countries, when you're in a recession, you just lower interest rates, and that's what it calls for. You look at output cap. That's pretty much your inflation and unemployment and recession things go together. An emerging market central banker you know, there are going to be two conflicting objectives, right? You know, you're in a recession, you want to lower the interest rate, but at the same time, your currency is depreciating. That depreciation is going to call for a higher interest rate. So in that sense, in an emerging market context, an open emerging market to capital flows in the world of global finance, it becomes very hard to manage the monetary policy, which is your job as an emerging market central banker, when, you know, the politics and the government, you know, tries to give part of that task you and then the other parts to keep himself. So because, I mean, if you are managing the capital flows and if you are, you know, somehow, you know, watching the exchange rate, and we know from pretty much all the emerging market central bankers, they always say there's one price we watch and that's the exchange rate. If you're in a situation like that, then which is linked to the interest rate and the inflation target, of course, because interest rate is your tool for inflation target, it becomes very hard, I think, to live in that world. That's the inherent dilemma. So I just want to say
you mean with a fixed exchange rate?
Both fixed and flexible, because as you know, the emerging markets always live in the world of fear of floating. Although they say they float,
yeah,
they never truly float as the United States.
But before I shut up and let me share the Turkish experience
sure.
with the IMF, which is, I think, very interesting, okay? Of course, there were many Turkish experiences with the IMF. I don't know how many.
Which one?
But the one when I was in the government. One thing we had to agree on was the inflation target for 2002, for the post-crisis year, okay? And the inflation in 2001, they may have revised the numbers a little bit, but was close to about 68%. And the average inflation in Turkey had been, you know, varying between 30 and 50, and was defying all economic logic, because the economists kept telling that either the inflation will go up and become hyperinflation, or you have a stabilization program and it will fall. But somehow have an inflation that floats around 30, 40, 50% is very unusual. But anyway, that I don't want to go into that. And we had a real debate. And of course, as so often happens, our central bank, the Turkish central bank, mainly agreed with the IMF that the target should be very ambitious, but not to the extent that the IMF wanted it to be ambitious. Okay, we wanted an ambitious target, but not from 68 as a starting point in 2001. So anyway, I won't go into the details, but at the end, the IMF said 20% is a good target, wanted us to have a 20% target. We said 40% is a good target, that because from 68 to 40, we will make it. And I was very interested in making it. In other words, because I think all targets, projected targets, had always been missed regularly. And so making what you say is an important aspect of credibility. Anyway, we agreed in the end on 35, and what the actual outcome was close to 30. But during that whole debate, it became clear that the target itself was a government choice with advice from the central bank, with in cooperation with the central bank, but was not a central bank choice, but a choice that was arrived at in conjunction with the central bank, but was a political choice by the government. And I personally believe that key choices, targets that affect the whole of society like this, are not technocratic choices. They are democratic citizen choices, even if the information is often very imperfect. Then the instrument with which you pursue that should be entirely left in the hands of the, you know, central bankers or finance ministry officials and so on. And I was just wondering whether this basic principle, which I think the fund agrees to, but in the 20, 30 years ago, I remember my fund colleagues, you were far from there, you were nowhere near yet, were not so happy with that. In other words, they had the feeling that they themselves knew so much more than the average citizen, particularly in a developing country, in an emerging country, that they should have the leeway of trying to negotiate an inflation target or an aggregate target And I think this has not changed a lot, where the democratic principles are. It's the same with the wage target. I mean, how can you as a minister negotiate with the unions about wages in the public sector if there's a letter of intent which sets a ceiling? I mean, that makes a mockery of democratic unions and democratic politics. And thankfully, the IMF has gone away and countries have gone away from side letters which were not published. Now things are, except if when they're market sensitive, they're published. So, you know, you cannot have a published public document which is at the same time subject to democratic negotiation. And I think this is very, very important in the present phase to push back populist pressures which will overshoot, and not to give the impression that there is a group of experts, either international or national, that knows things best and has, if you like, has the ability and the legitimacy to send targets which are essentially democratic targets in democratic countries, which of course is yet another big debate. Okay.
Just on this, Karen. Can I put my Peruvian hat on and very much agree with your comments, which is, I totally agree, you can't just pretend politics aren't there and it can't be externally imposed, but certainly in the case of Latin America, just giving a certain amount of independence and autonomy to central banks has been absolutely key to the years of macro stability and prosperity that we've had in the context of democracy. So it's sort of don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, because that's a very nuanced point.
Absolutely. I fully agree.
And if you allow me to make a point of precision, which I actually think is very important, is the following. One of the quotes from political science that I like best is from Isaiah Berlin, who has shifted a quote from Kant. And the quote is, "From the crooked timber of mankind, nothing straight will ever be made." What is he talking about? He's basically talking that in our interactions in society, we tend to put a tremendous amount of emphasis on our own interests. And if our fight for getting more of the cake is not constrained by rules, then everything gets crooked. And that speaks to the point that you were making about the primacy of distribution. Distribution is a fundamentally political problem. You could even say it's a central problem of politics. But Kant, when he was looking at these things, was basically saying that in order to make this work in the best way for everybody, you need rules and laws. And then John Rawls went one step further and said it's completely different to discuss actions in the context of a framework of laws and rules and discuss the design of the framework, the rules, and the laws. Now, clearly, what is regulated by law, framework, and rules is a political constitutional decision. Right. But then you may have decided that given your political system, it is best to delegate the target on an independent institution. That will depend on the nature of your political system and your political constitution, right? So I was just avoiding to, I would say, oversimplify.
Thank you very much. I think that the key word is here delegation, that you're doing this delegation in a legal way, in a democratic way, and you choose to do it.
Absolutely.
So the stark contrast is not as stark. But, you know, to get debate going and get excitement flowing a little bit, one has to sometimes.
But it can be constitutional, right? In some cases, you may think that the political problem that you're trying to control is so serious that you delegate at the constitutional level.
Right.
In some other cases, you may think that operational independence is enough.
Right. Okay, we'll open it a little bit to the floor, but, you know, try to make it as interactive as possible. Vito.
microphone's coming.
Thank you very much. On the question of rules, you know, if you have a rule, some institution must be responsible for promoting that rule. And the institution to promote the rule must have an accelerator or a brake to move toward or away from whatever you want to achieve. But in many cases, the situation is so complex that you don't know which is the accelerator and which is the brake. Take the case of the 2% of the central bank. They've been trying desperately to get to the 2% for several years now, creating trillions of dollars of assets, and we still are not there. So we have to recognize that this idea that you just fix a rule and you have solved the problem is just unrealistic in many cases.
George?
Yeah, question on the work done by the authors. you mentioned the fact that the book relates mainly to democratic or at least electoral politics. There's, of course, the whole number of countries where politics is not highly democratic, in fact, quite authoritarian. But nonetheless, let me give you a statement. Ken Rogoff postulated that fiscal policy is easy to explain, let's say, in the U.S. or democratic countries. When one party comes in, they essentially reduce taxes on their constituents and increase spending towards their constituents. And if you have alternating democratic system, they both parties, or whatever party is ruling, will end up with the same kind of levels of debt and deficit. My question is, have you in the book or in the research found out that this is the case as compared, let's say, to a majoritarian party that rules for much longer and accumulates debt or deficits much higher, let's say, than an alternating democratic system? And therefore, does it make any difference whether, in fact, a party stays in one place too long or whether, in fact, there's an alternating system as to the outcome with respect to deficits and debt?
It is complex. The two examples from the book that I think speak more loudly to your question are, first of all, in democratic politics, when governments have large majorities, the gap between what they actually achieve and what they promise is very small. That was one of the slides that Sanjeev showed. While if you have fragile governments, if you have a situation where the majority is tiny, where it's very difficult to mobilize a majority in parliament, in those cases, the gap is much bigger. And that is something that speaks to your question. The other aspect, which is also important, is that sometimes rules and institutions help. That is certainly the case when there is a strong ownership, and in a sense, oversimplifying, if the political system itself wants to be constrained. It is as if the political system sees a problem and tries to solve it in accordance with rules, rules operate as focal points and make it easier for the political system to deliver. If, on the contrary, there is no ownership of the rules, then the political system, which is very creative, will find ways of circumventing the rules. But there are many other results to speak to your question in the book. I would definitely encourage you to read it.
Jed?
Yes, I'm Jed Schilling. I worked at the bank for a long time, the World Bank, and with the IMF on occasion and argued with them on occasion about these policies. So I think that this is good progress to look at more broadly at the fiscal politics, but I think it needs to go farther to look at the sets of policies and the results it'll have on development, not just on reducing the budget deficit or meeting budget or inflation targets over the longer term. Because if they don't look at that, no policy is perfect, and just balancing the budget doesn't necessarily help growth or improve wages or things like that. I remember one discussion I had with them, an argument at length in Indonesia in 97, 98, after the financial crisis in Asia, where they were trying to cut the government expenditures and deficit because that was their way of dealing with crises, when the crisis there was not due to excessive government expenditure, but excessive financial sector lending and activities like we experienced here a few years ago. And we had to argue with them that if they cut back on government expenditures, they'd slow real growth and reduce the ability to have income to tax. We finally, after a year, convinced them that they had to let the government continue beneficial infrastructure expenditure. So I think that what is important to emphasize here is not just the fact that there are politics involved, but look at the overall policy structure over the medium term to see what policies are going to lead to more beneficial and sustainable growth.
I would say even in the long run, So the book follows, to my mind, in my reading, and we say that in the introduction, follows two traditions that come from Schumpeter. One is what we have been debating up to now, and it has to do with the economic theory of democracy, and Schumpeter pushed for that in Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy. But much earlier than that, in 1918, Schumpeter wrote about the crisis of the tech state. And what he was talking about is that politics are really at the roots of fiscal policy in general. And it took a very long-term historical perspective. Although we don't have many papers with that perspective in the book, I did contribute one myself with Laura Jaramillo and Philippe Fingender. And there we look at tax capacity as an important element for the determination of state capacity. And following Besley and Pearson, we show something which will come very intuitive to you, I believe, which is that all these indicators of state capacity, of quality of government provision of services, rule of law, protection of property rights, all of that, all those indicators are very much strongly positively correlated. And so, indeed, not only does one have to follow the medium-term approach that you were talking about, one would be well advised to take a long-term view and think about what is the best way to enable state capacity, and that's a fundamental political challenge.
Yes, that's a very good point. Shebnem, Anna, do you want to add anything?
I just want to, because I didn't get a chance, want to say that I am actually very impressed by the book. And then given that I'm a little bit of an outsider to whole fiscal policy literature, I think the book really does a great job in, bringing this exactly what, Vitter said, like, how, institutions and politics interact and the importance of deep, like, historical, political institutions in, turning into politics and in terms of, like, tax capacity and everything. And in fact, that chapter has this amazing, review of what Alexander Hamilton did and, how he insisted on paying the foreign debt fully so that, United States gain credibility in the international markets so you can keep borrowing there while you structure the domestic debt, which, of course, has a tremendous impact on the fiscal policy and politics afterwards. So, which is, again, bringing me to my praise that I think the book's focus on both these kind of deep factors and the relationship to, international governance and supranational institutions and also bringing evidence from emerging markets and developing countries is very admirable because, in general, this literature is very much about advanced countries. So I just want to add that.
Anybody from the panel who wants to add something?
Well, let me just add the praise for the book because I hadn't had a chance to do that. I think this is really an impressive volume, okay, in terms of the reach and scope, but also the care kind of with which this research is carried out. And I appreciate the careful way in which the conclusions are stated and the conditions under which the findings would be expected to apply are stated as well. It's audacious in calling it fiscal politics. It's a signal that the Fiscal Affairs Department is not going to be content with merely analyzing the economics, but is also going to make statements about the institutions and the rules and the politics. And I think that's a good thing for the fund to be doing. The I wanted to raise the point about the conclusions that we might be drawing from this book for the organization of fiscal policy in the euro area. And and I approach this kind of from the perspective of an American who's thought a little bit about the U.S. model. And I worry that Europeans draw the wrong lesson from the organization of the U.S. federal system. Sometimes they spend, give a undue weight, I think, to the balanced budget rules that apply to the states, and not enough weight to the no bailout norm that applies in the United States, in combination with the strength and depth of the fiscal center that we have in the United States to provide countercyclical stabilization in a crisis. And in combination with these things, it's this context in which the rules operate that make the rules viable, not the other way around, right? And so I'm concerned that in the politics within Europe, the rule, the definition of the rule, the strength of the rule is privileged kind of relative to kind of the development of these other structures that make the rule viable. And this book does a good job stating at the outset, right, that the context is very important in these chapters that deal with the rules. Where I might have a different preference than some of the authors in the book, although I think the authors, there's a range of views among the authors, is what do we do in a case where the context, that is the depth of the fiscal union and fiscal integration, is not co-evolving with the rules. Do we double down on the rules and strengthen them, or do we fall back on market discipline and re-emphasize the no bailout clause that was originally embodied in the Maastricht Treaty, or in an amended sort of way that debates over that clause, but reinforce the no bailout norm such as it's applied in the United States for such a long time. My preference is the second route because I find that that emphasizing these fiscal rules takes you down a road where fiscal intervention would eventually be required by the center into states which are dysfunctional. And I think this fiscal intervention is so invasive of state sovereignty in the ultimate case that this isn't sustainable in Europe. So my prescription for Europe is to follow the decentralized U.S. model that's laid out so nicely in the chapters in this book, rather than the centralized model.
Okay, Vito. So thanks for your comment. One of my favorite papers overall, not from this book, is The Nobel Lecture by Tom Sargent. And I think that in the spirit of fiscal politics, that's a truly wonderful lecture in which he argues that the crisis in public finance of many U.S. states in the 1840s and the decision by the federal government not to bail out the states, which was something which was hotly debated here in the U.S. It was a political decision to do it in that way. So Tom Sargent argues in his Nobel lecture that that was fundamental for the political system in the U.S., and in particular for the political autonomy of the states in the United States, so crucial for fiscal federalism, which reinforces the point that Randy just made.
Now, in the book, there is a paper that I co-authored with Luke, who's sitting there on the second row, and Tigran, who is sitting on the sixth row. And so if you want to know the details, we can answer any questions that you possibly can throw at us. And what we show is that the degree of respect for the rules during the period 1999-2015 was very weak. That is something that we as editor, Carlos Sanchez and I, interpret as lack of ownership on the part of the member states of the European Union. And so in the book, in the chapter, when we go to policy recommendations, we basically say that there are the two models that Randy was alluding to, a centralized model that you apply, say, in Germany or in Brazil, where there is the possibility of intrusion by the federal government on state politics. And there is the decentralized model that applies in the United States, and it's first and foremost based on market discipline. We don't take a view concerning which system is superior, but we basically say you should not be caught in the middle. You should make a choice. Because if not, you're going to have something which is inconsistent, and inconsistent combinations don't work.
I think that's a very important point and applies to other parts, I think, to financial systems and so on, although there are always exceptions where there are some special circumstances which, you know, necessitate a contradiction. Perhaps one, oh, Teresa.
A footnote on what Peter said. I mean, you know, the no bailout clause in the US has been in instead a large series of bailouts in the US. I think that it will be quite difficult to move one model to the other. It takes time for credibility. But my question was more. I mean, I see that in the book. I mean, from I haven't read the book. I look forward to getting a copy soon and reading it. I see that you basically focused a lot on the effect of on one function of the government, this stabilization, broadly defined. Have you looked also at the impact of both ideology and institutions on income distribution?
So in the book, the issue of income distribution is not ignored, but it's not at the center of the research. In the book, I was hoping that you were going to ask about other aspects of the government budget, because indeed we focus a lot on composition, whether there is a bias against investment, whether there are other compositional effects in the budget that are affected, including the composition of taxation. There are comments on distribution effects that are linked to that. But when it comes to the issue of distribution, and I speak also to the point that Carol made right at the beginning, we have a research and analytical agenda which is autonomous, and it's actually quite salient. Our fiscal monitor this fall will be dedicated solely to that topic. And although we do recognize the linkage with politics, we have a research agenda in that field that actually was already in place at the time of Vito, and then you continued, and so we are continuing on that tradition. It's more the political aspect which is newer.
May I add some? I think I haven't read the book. I read the first chapter. And I know you deal with it, but I don't know how much you deal with it. But, you know, there is a somewhat simplistic formulation sometimes in people's minds that says that you have to distinguish between investment and consumption. And if you think of a balance sheet, obviously, if you invest in public assets and they have a return, you may be strengthening the balance sheet of the public sector. Whereas if you spend it on pure consumption, you do the opposite.
Absolutely.
Okay. And this, in many ways, has been part of the European debate a lot. The problem is that it's not so simple to consider something an investment versus a consumption. I mean, in some cases, it may be clear, but capacity augmenting human capital, for example, which may be classified as consumption in some frameworks, is often as important as building yet another school or building or so on. So, in fact, what seems conceptually very correct and attractive distinction between investment and consumption, in practice, becomes much harder to figure out, although the conceptual correctness, I think, holds. Do you have any work in the book on that point?
Yes. So we look at issues like the quality and quantity of investment, and that depends on politics and institutions. It's one of those indicators that is most strongly correlated with other elements of state capacity. Although you're absolutely right that the issue of the borderline between capital and consumption is a hard one, it's still crucial. The main problem associated with saying that capital is good and consumption one has to be careful is that politicians faced by this classification will start classifying everything as capital, right? And so you need to have these things subject to reasonable criteria. And for that, you need strong rules, institutions, and frameworks. And what we are pushing for in the Fiscal Affairs Department is for a comprehensive balance sheet approach to general government accounts in which you can look at assets and liabilities, and then you can integrate the management of fiscal risks. But I do believe that you have been pushing for that yourself.
Yep. That's correct. Okay, any question from the audience? Yes? We'll take a few, two or three, and then.
It's more of a comment, not a question, going back to central banks, just because I was at the Central Bank of Egypt for 11 years at very tough times. And I think going back to what Vito was saying, the importance of having a framework whereby whether it's the central bank setting the goal, so having goal independence, but it always has to have the operational independence of using the instruments under its hands to actually achieve that goal is extremely important. And in the absence of well-defined frameworks, that's where the fear of floating comes, and that's where things become very messy and people don't understand what the central bank is doing. So it's the same way of fiscal rules, having monetary policy frameworks which are well understood by the public and then trying to achieve the targets over and over to gain that credibility over time is key. You had also mentioned in the past that the IMF would sometimes debate with the authorities, thinking that they have the higher intellectual having gone through two negotiations with the fund, I feel that this concept of homegrown programs has become more and more integrated in fund culture. So compared to maybe the Turkish example a long time ago, where we are today, I think there's a lot of listening to the authorities. There is a lot of also... I would say a quest towards more legitimacy by making sure that programs are actually debated in parliament or at least pass parliament. So there is this political or politics of consensus among the groups. Thank you.
Yeah, I think just a correction. I mean, for the record, that program in 2001, 2002, the IMF was listening very carefully, not just to the minister, but to the whole Turkish treasury and central bank. There was a long history of advising, debating, and in many cases, I mean, I was not really a politician, but the political level found that the Turkish technicians and the IMF technicians and the World Bank technicians basically agreed on 90% of the thing, and that the real issue was with politics. And so, you know, I just wanted to put that.
Emerging markets take that program as a, you know, as a case study,
yeah.
The Turkish program. So I think it's.
But there was really quite a bit of convergence of views and mutual support between the Turkish technicians and the IMF and World Bank technicians. I can give examples, but that's not the point today. Any other? Yes?
Just a brief question, Anirban Paul. I was interested in the 28-month, you know, where the second derivative turns negative. As a control group, because the underlying factor is a desire to hold on to power, not the democracy is the causal factor, was there a chance to examine non-democratic governments and to see how they would, in terms of critical points, change spending, but they have also access to coercive means, which democratic governments don't?
Can I layer a question on top of that? I thought that this chart with where the increase in investment spending by governments was peaking 28 months before the election was curious. I thought that peaked too early by my mental model about how political fiscal cycles work. I would have expected the government to want to have that peak much closer to the election. So I was wondering what whether there is a theoretical explanation for the timing of that peak.
Yeah, well, thanks for both questions. I worked on that chapter together with Sanjeev and Estelle, who is somewhere here. So the thing is that to your first question, no. We looked at democratic regimes only because it was about the months to the next election. And by definition, autocratic regimes don't have elections. I mean, they are competitive. They have elections basically to, you know, to select themselves or whatever. So it was just about democratic, you know, governments. And then going to your point, at the beginning of the project, we thought that, okay, initially one would expect politicians being willing to open up infrastructures and, you know, and schools and libraries closer to the elections. And that's actually what happens. But the thing is that the peak in the growth of investment happens before at the beginning of the electoral because they have to be built. So once they get to government, you see the peak, you see growth of public investment. The rate goes up in the first 2 years, really, first 18 months. And then, of course, it goes down. And there's a theory behind, which actually we mentioned, which is Rogoff 1990, saying, okay, those goods that are more visible, like transfers and pensions and wages, wage increases in the public sector, especially in emerging and low-income countries, are given closer to the elections because it's easier to influence because it's more visible, whereas public investment increases happen at the beginning. But that's a bit of the empirics and the connection with the theory.
No, Carol has to teach a course. Carol, do you want to say a few words before you have to leave us?
Well, I think this is a great discussion. And I think the one thing that is probably a fundamental thing that we are now even dealing with in the U.S. that I think is at the root of a lot of the discussion is the makeup of the institutional rules and structure and respect for those rules and structure and under what context can they be threatened, and then they matter even more, and under what context should they be more flexible, as in the EU context, where, you know, I think you were giving some great examples, and how the IMF manages that, you know, is going to require more dexterity going forward. But I think it's a really, really useful discussion to have. And the only other point I'd make, which I've certainly been finding in my work and really strikes me, is that we always think of the average voter in developed economies as being more informed and better educated. And yet my own experience, and certainly, yeah, certainly now watching what's been happening here, but also that the average sort of citizen in a lot of emerging market countries is much more economically savvy because, you know, Joe in formal sector knows what the exchange rate is every day. Do I keep my, you know, domestic salary in domestic currency, or do I trade it in for dollars or whatever it is? And I think it's time to sort of rethink some of those paradigms as well.
Okay, Kelly, I'm not saying you should go, but you do.
I actually should go if you don't.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mike Brown. Mike.
And her book is out.
Take care of itself.
May I react very quickly on
yes,
this?
Yes, sure.
So two things. One that I should have said before, but I forgot. In a representative agent model, like many times we use as economists, there are no politics, right? You cannot possibly have politics in a representative agent model. You need to have heterogeneity to have politics. So in a sense, that's another way of saying that politics require distribution considerations, even if there are other considerations as well. The second aspect, which is very important in what Carol said, is how does the IMF tackle this issue of very different experiences around the world? And I do think that that is a crucial contribution from the book. Yep. So the book is based also to a very large extent on data sets that are compiled by the IMF itself. We have a data set of economic and political variables that covers 94 countries and for about four decades, and that allows our analysis to provide cross-country comparisons. We also have a database on fiscal rules that covers almost as many countries. Xavier was one of the promoters of that work. It's now in research. That work is being continued in FAD. It's a very prominent work. And we have a third data set, which is international, which is on fiscal institutions that covers 39 countries. And unfortunately, most of those 39 countries are advanced countries. For the other data sets, we cover the three country groups that we normally focus on, advanced, emerging, and low-income countries. And it's from the comparison of experiences around the world that we determine what is best practice, what is likely to work, and where.
Good. Vito?
Back to my question that was ignored, although I thought was a key question, you know, that we discuss rules as if rules were the tenth commandment, you know, come from God and you have to follow it. But the truth is that take monetary rules, you know, Blanchard tells us that we should have 4%. Somebody else was proposing 3%. The central bank wanted to go after 2%. I always thought that zero was the right rules. At the same time, I know that the central bank have not even been able to achieve the 2%. So here there are two questions. One is the validity of the rule. There's more and more doubts today. You know, economists don't have the reputation that they had in the 60s. And what they say is always challenged. And the second is the ability of the institution that are supposed to achieve, satisfy that rule, to do it. The more I see the working of countries and governments and central banks, the more doubtful I become that they are capable of doing that because of complexity, because of globalization, because of the effect of irrational exuberance or whatever. So I would like to have some comment on this. You know.
No, absolutely, Vito. And I thought I had.
Just one second. I just discovered that yet another FAD director was in the room with Carlos Cotarelli. But I don't... Okay, all right.
May I? So I thought I had answered your question in the following way. First of all, in the fund and in the fiscal affairs department, we're always examining rules, frameworks, and institutions, try to see how they perform around the world, and trying to push outward the frontier of best practice. And one of the works that we have in the pipeline is about the next generation of rules. That is something that we expect to see in place in the next year or so. I also made the point that rules should not, in a sense, be evaluated in a vacuum, and that in many instances, rules work as designed when they emerge endogenously from the will of the fiscal system itself, when the fiscal system perceives that there is a problem and the rule helps solving that problem and coordinating the various actors of the political system, while if the rule, for whatever reason, is imposed from the outside on the political system will find ways of working around it. And of course, we can have a much longer debate about rules and how they work in practice. And that is always fascinating, but it would take much longer.
All right, we're coming to the end of this great session, and we have just maybe a few minutes left, and I want Vitor Gaspar to have the last word. But let me, I see a few hands, but I think we really run out of time, unless you can do it in a very telegraphic, like two-second type question. Anyway. Okay. You, there are two questions, but really telegraphic. No.
So
I also have one that I want to
get. This is my telegraph. At the heart of what you are discussing, what I find is politics. I mean, but my question is about how can you, and this should be at the heart also of the debate between elections in democracies, how can you explain this very complex set of principles and rules to the general public without sounding too technocratic and basically boring?
Yes, very quickly.
Hi. First, one comment. I heard Olivier Blanchard earlier this month during a lecture in the London School of Economics saying that he had changed his views about the 2% inflation target and that he was now comfortable with it, given that he was more convinced that negative interest rates would be more effective. My question is on the chapter of the book about low-income countries, and if you could give us a bit more information about what it says. And I'm mostly thinking of countries where politics are more power, based on power and not so much on institutions and rules.
Yeah, and I actually, the gentleman asked pretty much what I also wanted to ask, but it seems that there has been a convergence of kind of economists' views within certain boundaries compared to 20, 30, 40 years ago, where some economists would say that a 20% fiscal deficit was no problem or 20% inflation was okay. I mean, we have reached a much stronger, not consensus, but, agreement on some basics. But we can't say that agreement and those details have become in a more meaningful way part of the democratic consensus, I think. And that, that's at the heart of, I guess, that's why your book is so valuable, I think, because you have to inject, you have to confront the two for this to emerge.
So let me take the second question first, and yours, and the first question last. So we don't have a chapter on low-income countries in the book. We try to cover low-income countries throughout the book, and there are quite a number of examples and discussions about low-income countries. If you allow me, to again draw on my own research. One of the results that we present in the book is that we identify a tipping point for tax capacity that we measure as a tax to GDP ratio. The estimate of the tipping point that we get is at about 13% of GDP. That is for tax revenues, strictly speaking. So it's not general revenues of government. It does not include social contribution. It does not include royalties, income from property, aid flows. It's tax. And we see that when countries go above that threshold, there is an acceleration in growth that is long-lasting and significant economically and statistically. Now, that is important for low-income countries because about half of low-income countries are below this threshold. So if you think about development policy and fiscal policy as development policy, building state capacity, building tax capacity is at the heart of it. And I think that's a strong message for low-income countries. Not the only one. Not the only one. There are things about the procedure for public investment, which is equally important for low-income countries. So you have a lot on low-income countries in the book. And again, I would encourage you to go and see it. Now, in terms of the democratic society and the role of experts in a democratic society, the way I see it is what I believe I learned again from John Rawls. John Rawls, who was certainly an expert, said that expertise does not have a special status in the democratic debate. It is incumbent on experts to be persuasive or be politically relevant. And having just purchased your book of essays on various topics, which are very short and to the point, I do believe that you take that quite seriously yourself.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Well, thank you, Vitor. Thank you, all of you, for having joined us here and engaged in the debate also from the floor. I think it was a very enlivening debate, and I think many of us will read most of the book, let's put it that way.
Appreciate it.
Thank you very much, and come again.
Shebnam Hanım, thank you very much.